It's my pleasure on your behalf to welcome our speaker, the Right Honourable John Redwood. Born in 1971, Mr. Redwood was educated at Kent College, Cambridge. 1951, I'm terribly sorry. It's the millennium, it creeps up on us. Educated at Kent College, Cambridge, Canterbury, I beg your pardon, and Oxford, from where he holds the degree of Doctor of Philosophy. His elected political career began with 4 years on Oxfordshire County Council, and since 1987, he's been the member for Wokingham in Berkshire, a seat which he still holds. He rose rapidly in Parliament, holding junior posts at the Department of Trade and Industry and the Department of the Environment, before taking on that key post for aspiring Tory politicians, the Secretary of State for Wales. In June 1995, he showed considerable political courage, although some might say less political judgment, by taking on the then Prime Minister, John Major, for leadership of his parliamentary party. Under Mr. Haig, he has been and is Shadow Secretary of State for the Department of Trade and Industry, and he is again showing considerable political courage by coming to address us tonight. His subject is British science and industry. What should the government do, Mr. Redwood?
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for that very flattering introduction, at least the bit of it which said that I was born in 1971. I think I now have reached the age where it is always nice to be given an underestimate rather than an overestimate of how many years have passed by. I stand before you tonight equipped, if at all, in a rather lopsided manner to address you, because I am no scientist. I come from the humanities tradition at Oxford University, but maybe I have a few qualifications in that I have been deeply involved in the 80s and 90s with the formulation of government policy towards business and science, and I have myself been a practicing industrialist and banker with some practical experience of how scientific ideas and insights are handled in a commercial context. One of my heroes when I was an industrialist was Josiah Wedgwood. To me, he brought together all those strands of human talent, curiosity, scientific experimentation, the Heath Robinson tradition of British science and commercial development, with enormous business talents. Josiah Wedgwood knew about marketing long before a single manual had been written on the subject or before the awful word had come into general circulation. It was Josiah Wedgwood who experimented away in his early days with different types of glazes and colours so that he could establish something new and exciting for the dinner tables of the great and the well-heeled. He then discovered that if you offered free dinner services to the royal families of Europe, especially to the Russians, then all the aristocrats in those countries had to buy similar dinner services to try and keep up with their royal masters. Shrewd marketing indeed. A little lost leader never comes amiss to get the follow through. Josiah was also very good at combining the new and the old when it came to design. He knew that you needed to develop new patterns and new designs, and he also knew that rediscovering the past was often the best and cheapest way of so doing. And so some of his best-known concoctions and products were based on the rediscovery of Greek artifacts, which he was able to recreate with new glazes and new techniques in the kilns that he developed. I had to do something based on what he'd done in a British tile business. I wasn't nearly as successful, and I didn't have the talent he had with glazes and experimentation. But I found with a modern British tile business that had been falling heavily behind its Italian competition, we did need to create new designs, have something that excited people. You don't always sell on price, you often sell on design and innovation. And I did use the cheating method. I went back to the old pattern books of the company I had taken over and found that some of the older patterns, the Victorian stars and the early 20th century stars, were not only extremely good, but were extremely marketable, because people still lived in houses from that era and were rather grateful to rediscover something very akin to the proper tile that once had graced the walls of those houses before the awful 60s ripped them all out and replace them with any colour you liked, as long as it was white. Business needs to bring together those different skills. In the modern world, it is argued that you can no longer have a genius like Josiah Wedgwood, who can do it all for himself with a small team and limited capital. It is said that you now need enormous teams of people capable of carrying out the research function. Very often that research function has to be separate from or segregated away from the functions of marketing and sales and production. If you take that too far, I think you can kill innovation. You can lose some of the magic that the talented entrepreneur or the entrepreneurial company can bring to the marriage of science and commercial development, and you certainly incur enormous costs. We live in a world where people feel that you have to do everything by means of partnership. I think you can overdo the concept of partnership. You can overuse the word, and you may discover that partnerships are simply a cop-out. They can so easily become devices for no one taking any responsibility. They can so easily become ways of spending other people's money in a fairly agreeable way without having many demanding targets impressed upon you. They can become extremely elaborate and bureaucratic, and they don't necessarily marry the best science with the best technical solution and the best sales and marketing. Modern business life moves extremely quickly. Some of the largest technical and industrial partnerships move rather too slowly for the pace of the world. We see this in the evolution of the computer industry. Its life cycles are rather shorter than more traditional industries. We see a generation of new business replacing a generation of old business within perhaps 10 years or less. In my younger days, IBM was regarded as the dominant presence in the computer industry. It then suffered a major competitive challenge from a series of new, smaller entrepreneurial businesses which sprung up with what they thought was a better or cheaper answer, who had carried the technology of the small computer to greater perfection and represented a serious challenge to IBM making the very large mainframe computers of the previous generation. In turn, those companies aggrandized themselves, became rather larger, rather stodgier, and then the game moved to Microsoft, who discovered that the way to dominate the next wave of innovation and technology was by being superb at software and making sure that your software went into as many people's hardware as possible and making the software a more valuable part than the hardware which had dominated the industry a mere 10 or 15 years earlier. Waves of innovation, often beginning with a creative genius in the fast-moving industry, a Josiah Wedgwood of the computer world, and then in turn becoming bureaucratic and suffering from a new or strong competitive threat. I think we should learn from what has been happening in the computer industry and understand that if you've got to the point where you think the answer has to be arrived at by teams of experts working in loosely formed partnerships that are not very accountable for very large and rather mature companies, you have probably already lost the plot and that the innovation, the new idea, is going to take place somewhere else. One of the curious developments in British industry, I think, is what has been happening in the motor car industry. We've been through several cycles of evolution and decline in the British motor industry over the 20th century. It is a 20th century industry. There were practically no motor cars or motor car producers at the turn of the century, and it is now a mature but very important and fairly dominant industry in our daily lives at the end of the 20th century. In the immediate pre-war and certainly in the post-war period, the British industry was characterized by a series of fairly entrepreneurial and quite small-scale companies that from a British base were able to be very dominant both in the United Kingdom market itself and in a range of markets around the world. Some of it was based on the strength of old empire and new commonwealth, but some of it was based upon the engineering skills and the design excellence inherent in the businesses. It is one of those ironies of later 20th century history that the British motor industry took some of its skills to Germany immediately after the end of the Second World War and provided some of the technical and production advice to re-establish the German industry and to rescue the Volkswagen Beetle from an otherwise ignominious end with the wrong associations, and to help turn it into an extremely successful world-beating product at the lower end of the market. The British industry began to meet its Waterloo from the late 1960s onwards. And from the end of the 60s through until the early 80s, the British industry was in secular decline. This was a time of interesting developments in the way the British government and the industry related one to another. It followed enormous mergers which had put together most of the talent and innovative skill of the British motor industry of the 50s and early 60s into a single conglomerate, the British Motor Corporation, then to become British Leyland. It was also a conglomerate which, as the 70s developed, received unprecedented levels of government support, finance, and encouragement. By the early 80s, the business was in terminal decline. It had lost most of its markets abroad and lost a great chunk of the market at home. Its market share had plummeted from over half, if you aggregated the constituent businesses in the early 60s, to about 40% by 1970, to half that at the bottom of the cycle at the end of the 70s, early 80s. It does, I think, give one pause to thought when people say what British business needs is more mergers, more agglomeration, and then more direct financial government support to the merged groups that result. The history of the British motor industry shows that it was far more successful in its entrepreneurial competitive days and was at its worst when it was merged with government encouragement and then financed by the taxpayer. The taxpayer bought two completely new model ranges of cars during the height of the subsidy period at British Leyland. The problem was that neither of those ranges attracted the British people at all. And so British Leyland lost out on the one thing that a successful business needs, which is, of course, customers. And we saw the business, short of revenue from customers, having to rely on more and more subsidy from government and getting into deeper and deeper difficulties. What the conglomerate did was what conglomerates so often do. It thought that the answer was not innovation and better science, but rationalization. And so it killed off some of the most hopeful features of the British Leyland Group. It killed off the MG Mark and the sports car that went with it. It killed off Triumph. It killed off some of the great names of British motoring that it had inherited, concentrating on Austin and Morris, and then just concentrating in the end on the Rover brand and taking that down market to cover the complete range. It was, I think, by any analysis, a comprehensive disaster, and disproved the notion that large sums of government money routed through a single company can provide the design, engineering, and product answers that a competitive marketplace requires. The business started to pick up when a number of foreign innovators arrived in this country, discovering that they could hire back the very designers, scientists, and engineers that British Leyland had not been able to put to profitable use, and design cars here that people did actually want to buy, not only in Britain, but in Europe and around the world. When I cut the first sod on the Nissan Technology Center in the 1980s, when they arrived in the United Kingdom, I asked the Japanese chairman, who graced the occasion with his presence, why he had come to Britain. I tried not to express too much surprise. I reassured him it was the right thing to do and was delighted he'd come. But I asked him why he'd come, because I wanted to hear from the most powerful man in the company why they had come. And his answer was very clear, very simple, and exactly the one I wanted to hear. I don't think that was the reason he gave it. He just said that you have the talented designers and engineers in this country that we need to hire, not just to design the British Nissans, but to design the European Nissans, even to contribute to the design of the global Nissans, which they have now replaced the European ones with in no small measure. A fine testimony to the excellence of British engineering and science, and a sign that a certain type of management and organization could use that skill, whereas the original British management system under BLMC, then BL, was unable to do the same thing. Even more interesting in the case of the British motor industry is the enormous success the United Kingdom has in the small end and the high-tech end when it comes to Formula One racing cars. It comes as a surprise, even to a lot of British audiences who don't follow Grand Prix racing, to learn that even Ferrari has had to come to the Thames Valley in Britain to find out how to make a car which has a chance of winning a race. And in a cluster of small businesses in the southern Midlands and in the Thames Valley, we have the greatest concentration of excellence in engineering and high-speed automotive design work of anywhere in the world. They don't only come here to design and build the Grand Prix cars for the global Grand Prix circuit, but the Americans also come to Britain for help with their racing cars for their own special type of motor racing. Those businesses have the characteristics of the exciting motor car businesses of the 30s and 40s in the United Kingdom. They tend to be small. They tend to be led by an entrepreneur or a small team of entrepreneurial engineers or science-based experts. They are enthusiasts. They are very keen on their product. They really do want their product to go faster and to win races. And they even manage to operate for a range of different clients. In my own constituency, a lot of the gearboxes are made for the competing families of car that bash around the Grand Prix circuits. That company has satisfied its range of customers. I can't remember all the team names, but let us suppose it is both Ferrari and Williams, for example. They have satisfied them that they will do separate lines of technical development for the two different teams and that they will not cross-fertilize between them. They will keep their secrets within their business, and they have very profitable business on the back of those separate developments where there is an interaction between the wishes of the Ferrari team or the Williams team on the one hand and the expertise in that business on the other at making those gearboxes. So we are recreating at the high-tech fast end of the motor car engineering business the kind of excellence which we saw when the whole British motor industry was a world beater. One of the worries is why can't we translate that? Why can't we scale it up from being a world winner in the high-speed end of the motor car business into being a world winner in the normal saloon car marketplace? It is a tragedy, in my view, that now every major British brand of the 20th century in the motor car industry has been sold to a foreign competitor. If you had said to me 25 years ago that by the end of the century, not only Rover, but also Bentley and Rolls-Royce would be owned by German companies, I think I would have said that was ridiculous. I would have assumed that British capital, British enterprise, if not the British government, would have taken action to ensure those businesses were supported and flourished. Yet there has been a marked reluctance in the City of London to get behind those businesses and to find the managements for them that can lead them on to a successful conclusion in the next century to mirror their success in the middle part of the 20th century. I remember when Rolls and Bentley were announced for sale, and I contacted several people in the merchant banking world in the City of London, and I said, I can't do anything myself because I am a Member of Parliament and Shadow Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, and it would not be proper for me to do so, but isn't there someone in your organisation who would like to put together a British bidding consortium, raise £1 billion, £500 million to buy the company and £500 million to design the new models and improve the production facilities and scale the whole thing up and start to make some money out of it? When I looked at the figures, they were almost unbelievable. I was told that they only built just over 2,000 Rolls-Royces and Bentley cars each year, that half of those were sold into the United Kingdom market. That implied to me that if only 1,000 cars were going to the whole of the continent of Europe, the whole of North America, the whole of South America, the whole of the Middle East, and the whole of Japan and Asia, the market was far from saturated. I think it would be quite possible for Rolls-Royce and Bentley to retain its cachet whilst selling certainly 5 times and maybe 10 times that number of cars in the non-UK markets. And if you started to sell that number, then the economics of production would look rather different, and the possibilities of making a reasonable return were that much greater. To cut a long story short, there was no one in the City of London who thought that was worth doing. They thought it was quite feasible for BMW or conceivably for Volkswagen to take on those businesses, to scale up production and make a success of it, and they were very happy to advise either or both of those companies on how they might procure one or other or both of those famous brands. but there was no one in the City of London who wanted to take the risk, I thought a very modest risk, of putting together a British consortium, raising serious money, and showing that it was still possible for British management to offer leadership and direction to such an important tradition of British manufacturing and coach building excellence. The government does have quite a big agenda for trying to stimulate British enterprise and trying to reconnect science to business in a variety of ways, and I would like to just examine that. I will try and set out for you what I think they're trying to do, and then you may forgive me if I make the odd critical comment on what they're trying to do and why I think it may not be too sensible. The first thing the government has recognised under this new Secretary of State, Peter Mandelson, is what I've been saying to you earlier, that you have most opportunity for success if you allow business to cluster, if you have a series of competing, smaller entrepreneurial businesses that set up in a given area and bounce off each other, create marketplace opportunities for each other, as well as competing against each other. It took a visit at the taxpayers' expense to Silicon Valley for Mr. Mandelson to make this remarkable discovery. I don't disagree with it. I'm just surprised he had to go so far and it took him so long. I could have shown him clusters in Britain at much less cost to the taxpayer, clusters that have been successful for much longer than Silicon Valley in California. Not very far from this august institution, there is a remarkable cluster called the City of London. You have there more foreign banks clustered together than in any other world financial capital. Prior to the advent of huge banking success in the City of London, you had clusters of traders in a whole variety of important trades, ranging from candle making to butchery in the days when people were still allowed to eat beef on the bone. You had those major trades clustering together in the City of London, forming marketplaces there and benefiting from each other's company. So I would agree with the government that clusters work, but I would not agree with the government that Britain has not yet discovered clusters or has been unable to use them. What is Harley Street but a cluster? What is Savile Row but a cluster? What is Carnaby Street but an old-fashioned cluster? There are numerous examples of how clustering together can work. And it was that thought which lay behind the contrived creation of a cluster in Cambridge, which was successful. The university went out of its way to create a high-tech cluster, and it has worked. And the spontaneous cluster of high-tech businesses in my own part of the country, the Thames Valley, which, whilst not as big and as numerous as Silicon Valley in California, is one of the most serious clusters of high-tech creativity in the world, and is based upon that same interplay between the big companies and the small companies, the entrepreneurial companies, and you can see in the same location the different generations of competition and technology jostling together in the marketplace. The second thing which the government has made very clear is that it thinks business has to operate in a smarter way. Well, none of us can really object to that, although I do object to the assumption that somehow business hasn't been trying over the last 20 or 30 years. In my experience, business has been through a pretty tough time in Britain. It has tried enormously hard, and there are now many examples of businesses that have proved to be very successful, despite the rather variable business climate which has been delivered to them for one reason or another. But I do think the government is in danger of encouraging a very crude increase in productivity simply by sacking people, rather than by genuinely encouraging smarter working and new products. The government has some figures from McKinsey, which I believe are very unreliable, saying that British business is 20% less productive than business in France or Germany. They are measuring labour productivity or output per head. Why do I think the figures are unreliable? Well, because they're based on a phony exchange rate. McKinsey think it's too easy to take the market exchange rate, which would give us a fairly favourable comparison with France and Germany. They have chosen to take an exchange rate of their own choosing, which they say is the correct exchange rate, which produces the 20% difference. Indeed, most of the 20% shortfall can be explained by the difference between the exchange rate they've chosen and the market rates that we have been enjoying or suffering under in the last few months, when the pound has been quite high against the French and German recently devalued currencies. The danger of what the government is now saying is that business will respond by sacking a quarter or a fifth of its workforce to try and make good the productivity gap. And that is not normally the way, in order to stimulate new ideas, new products, innovation, and apply better science to business. It is normally the way to lower morale, to make people extremely defensive, and to go into the mode where cost-cutting is the only thing which matters. It is much better to get out of a productivity problem, if you have one, by selling more product than by sacking more employees. It is much better to get out of a shortfall of profits by finding more higher value products you can promote and sell, that you can manufacture successfully, than to try and cut the costs on commodity lines, which will in the end prove self-defeating. Britain is too rich a country to make a good living out of commodity products and services. Britain is a country which will have to rely increasingly on more talent and brain power going into its goods and its services in order to maintain and increase the standard of livings we enjoy. The third element in the government strategy has been to dress up the numbers on the science budget. We welcome any improvement in the science budget. I wouldn't pretend that the Conservatives left the science budget at record and generous levels. And I do think anything that can be done to stimulate high-quality scientific work in universities through the science budget is welcome. There is a role for blue sky research, and I wish to come on in a minute to the relationships between blue sky research, university campuses, and businesses. But it is very important to have proper facilities and good people sensibly remunerated in the academic world, in the scientific establishment, as a base for developing those links between the universities and the business world. So we do welcome anything they can do to increase the science budget. My fear is that the increases are not as big as have been brandished. The government develops the technique of lumping 3 years' figures together and then claiming the 3 years' increase as if it were a single year increase. And I think they still have terrible problems in general university financing. Indeed, my university contacts and friends tell me that the gap which had developed between university pay and business pay, which was not developing favourably under the last government, has got markedly worse under the first 18 months of this government, and that far from solving the problem, there are still considerable difficulties in providing decent remuneration in the university from the university budgets that we see before us. The government is, of course, introducing the tuition fee, an extremely unpopular measure with the current student generation and some of the parents of the potential student generation. I just hope that the money that comes from that tuition fee, now it is going to be a reality, can in part be additional money so that there is more money to pay for good people in the universities, the good people already there, the good people otherwise who would leave and go to other occupations, so that we can keep a good level of expertise in the universities properly remunerated. The fourth element in the government's policy is to actively promote large-scale European mergers, particularly in the defence industries. This, I think, could prove to be the most damaging part of their interventionist industrial strategy. There are strong arguments for saying that the defence industries, like any other industry, need to keep a reasonable number of competing players. There are even more strong arguments for saying that a lot of the expertise, and certainly a great chunk of the marketplace, will continue to lie on the other side of the Atlantic, in the United States of America. All the time that the US is prepared to pay significant sums out of tax revenue to properly defend the West, and all the time that the European countries as a whole are not prepared to collect sizable sums in tax to properly defend the West for ourselves, it is quite obvious that the main market for defense equipment is going to rest in the United States of America. Just look at the relative scale of the American Air Force, Navy, and ground troops compared with the combined forces of France, Germany, and Britain, the three most serious players in Western Europe. It is obviously the case that the amount of research and development and the pace of innovation is so much greater in the United States of America, based on massive state funding of the activities, compared with anything that Europe has so far attempted. So to the extent that some of our companies do need partners, do need to increase their scale, I think you can make a very good case to say that we should be looking at transatlantic mergers rather more than at mergers within Europe. The advantage of the transatlantic merger is that we both get some participation in the technical excellence and innovation that they have already undertaken in the United States of America. And we do need their skills and weaponry to help defend us. And we get a part share in a much larger market, and they are going to remain by far and away the biggest world market for defence equipment for the foreseeable future. I think it would be quite wrong for the government to acquiesce in or help engineer the French idea that you need to group all of the main European companies together in a single entity. You need to be relaxed about the Americans attempting to do something similar in the US if antitrust permits in the US, and that then sufficient competition is guaranteed by the clash of the two titans, Euro Defence Co. against US Defence Co. It's quite obvious who would win. It's quite obvious who would have far bigger technical and financial resources from its government. It is quite obvious who has access to the bigger market. And it is quite obvious which industry at the moment is in the stronger technical position. So I think we should be very careful about that particular proposal that seems to be emerging from the discussions between defence and finance ministers within the European community. The government has also said that an important part of its industrial and commercial and scientific policy is to promote a much more aggressive competition framework. I have some sympathy with this. I think the more you can make markets competitive, by and large, the better it's going to be. But as someone who genuinely believes that rather than as a convert, I do believe you have to take the pace of change at a pace that businesses can accept. I speak as one who did champion the cause of telecommunications privatization and competition in the 80s when it was a far from popular case. Indeed, I started the case in the 70s and had to counter-argue many of the technical arguments that put forward as to why they said it was quite impossible to have more than one telephone provider in a country the size of Britain. I do now advocate opening the water industry up to proper competition using the water pipe system as a common carrier. I think if you can do it for gas, which is a very explosive substance, you can do it from water, which is a bit more sluggish. But there are lots of technical objections still that we're having to clear away. But I think you have to go at a certain pace. You can only have so many targets at a time, and you have to try and carry the industries and people with you. You have to find champions or leaders within each industry who are prepared to accept the time has come for them to face the competitive treatment and to find the agents of change who will actually run the competitive businesses to make a reality of the market idea. This government has done two rather strange things. It has first of all passed a blockbuster Competition Act based upon Treaty of Rome, Treaty of European Union competition provisions, but of course different from Treaty of Rome, because Treaty of Rome was about interstate trading, whereas the British Competition Act has to be about intrastate trading, which is a rather different kettle of fish and has to be subject to rather different propositions. They have said that this Competition Act is designed to shake up all the remaining monopoly and cartel areas of British business. They have threatened business with a massive increase in competition, but they will not specify which businesses and which industries. And we still have no idea whether the Act is going to be strongly enforced or weakly enforced, or whether there will be a series of deals through Brussels, allowing a lot of the current restrictive practices that are legalized to continue in existence. So I think the jury is out on how far they're going to go. I would rather we had a government which said, this is difficult, we can only do so many, but this is the list of things we would like to tackle for the time being. The next part of the government strategy is to encourage venture capital. Their latest idea is to talk to the pension funds about why they are not putting more into venture capital investment. Well, I can tell them the answer, I'm sure you can as well. People in pension funds do not take the risk of more venture investments, because there are valuation and quotation problems, and because their trustees would not be very understanding if they had bought a series of venture capital investments that took 5 to 10 years to mature, when the trustees, often the industrial companies themselves, their managers, are insisting on quarterly or even monthly good performance measured by some wretched stock market index. Until the culture of the industry, pensions industry, changes, and it is a joint culture between the city and the industrial companies that own the pension funds. Before that culture changes, I don't think the government is going to make very much progress in encouraging trustees and investment managers of pension funds to put a materially larger proportion of their investment money into venture capital. I think the way to get more venture capital is the traditional time-honoured British method of offering generous tax breaks to richer individuals. We have seen in the Sunday Times that 147,000 of our fellow citizens are now millionaires with an average of 1.5 million each. That's quite a lot of people with substantial sums of money. And that's 1.5 million of free money, not including the value of their house and their Bentley or whatever else they have. We learn in that same newspaper that there are several millions more people who have free money of between 50,000 and 500,000. Again, reasonable sums of money, depending on your lifetime demands and how old you are, money that would be available for more interesting investment. I think that is what the government should concentrate on. And it should concentrate on having the tax breaks and the promotions necessary to get more of that money mobilised to encourage more venture capital in the United Kingdom. We began in the Conservative period in the 80s. I identified, when I was head of the policy unit, the complete lack of venture capital in Britain compared with the US. And the then Chancellor and Prime Minister did introduce some tax breaks, which did stimulate the beginning of a marketplace. More of it went into refinancings and rescue jobs than we would have liked. Of course, we'd have liked more of it to be in Greenfield. I think that needs to be given a further push by a review and perhaps an improvement in those tax breaks and incentives that are available. The final element in the government strategy, and again, one in principle with which I entirely agree, is to beef up the educational prowess and success of our country. The disagreement between the opposition and the government is not over the aim, it is over the methods. I don't think anyone has thought through yet how much further they wish higher education expansion to go, and what a difference it makes to a university culture if you move from having 1 in 8 or 1 in 10 of all young people going to university to 1 in 3, and how much difference it would make if you moved on from 1 in 3 to 1 in 2. I don't think the government has really addressed the imbalance in Britain, where we don't suffer from a shortage of graduates, but where we suffer from a shortage of trained technicians from what Germany would call the middle strata, the people who are trained to a good standard in more skills based on professional expertise, engineering expertise, technical expertise, rather than academic considerations. We would also say that the problems do begin in the schools. There was a very interesting interview the other day on the radio where someone was putting forward the idea that one of the reasons fewer boys now go on in secondary schools to study scientific and technical subjects is that in the primary schools, teachers are largely women, and women traditionally have less interest, by and large, there are many notable exceptions, but on average, less interest in science and technology and practical things than men. And the argument went from this person on the radio that this was causing a change in the way boys looked at the future because they were being given more encouragement and excitement on the arts and humanities side in the primary school than they were on the science and technology side. Some believe that that carries through into the secondary school, where there are so many more exciting job opportunities than school teaching for a well-trained engineer or technologist, and the same doesn't apply to the art student to the same extent who has graduated, and so there is a fear that there is an inherent imbalance in schools encouraging boys and girls to be more interested in humanities and less in science. I think there is one welcome development that goes in the opposite direction, which is that I think women and girls are now, on average, much more interested in these subjects than their predecessor generation, and that is proven by the figures and what we see happening in the engineering and scientific professions. But even so, there is still quite an imbalance, and it obviously does affect the numbers of talented people who want to take up a scientific career. It must be right that anything that can be done to raise school standards generally will help train more and better scientists. Many young people I've spoken to say they have not offered themselves for scientific and technical A-levels and degrees because they believe they are more difficult, and they have foolishly low expectations of their own talents, and so they say, well, I'll do something easy like history or sociology, like you did, Mr. Redwood, rather than doing something difficult, like many of you did, doing something as they see it with more rigour and more demands upon their time. So we do need to address that problem in the school. It would certainly help if the government would also encourage a higher degree of value to the professions many of you represent. It is very noticeable that in a country like Germany, someone learned in engineering or science would be extremely well thought of by the local community. Whereas in Britain, I'm told that if you say you're an engineer, people still might think you mend the washing machine rather than being a very talented and well-educated person who is capable of all sorts of exciting technical and industrial developments that would not be open to the less well-trained person. So the government could help by trying to reposition, re-image the professions of science and technology. If this government is good at one thing and one thing only, it is at creating images in the media. And it would be very helpful if they turn this skill to good effect by promoting science and technology as something worthy in itself and something good for an exciting future and career for young people. So how then does the opposition's agenda for business and science differ, if at all, from the government's? Well, it does in a number of ways. And we would say that the way to encourage clusters and entrepreneurial business is to lower taxes, not to increase them. We would say that you want less regulation rather than more. We would say that you do need to promote venture capital, but it's best done by a tax break rather than by lecturing pension funds. We would say that you want a strong competition policy, but it must be pursued in a pragmatic way, identifying suitable targets and preparing the ground before hitting them too hard. And of course, we believe that educational standards must be lifted, but we believe that is done by promoting a greater diversity of school rather than by abolishing grammar schools and assisted places. We believe it is done by encouraging more choice for both pupil and parent, rather than closing down choice and saying that the local comprehensive must work and will work without any challenge to it that offers you any kind of choice at all. There was a very interesting experiment conducted in the 1980s in the state of Delaware in the United States of America. The United States of America, as a federal union, doesn't have such common and harmonized taxation as Mr. LaFontaine wants to have in the currency union of Western Europe. The states of the union can still differentiate their business taxes to a very considerable extent, whatever the federal government may believe. Governor DuPont was elected on a joint ticket of cutting corporate taxes and spending more on public services. Many wanted to believe him, so he was elected. What was more remarkable was his method actually worked. He cut taxes so dramatically in the state of Delaware, the tax rates, that they were absolutely inundated with people establishing their businesses in Delaware rather than in the neighboring states. Indeed, for quite a long time, it may still be true. British firms thinking of setting up in America were always advised that they should establish in Delaware rather than somewhere else because it was the best location for tax purposes for an American operation. So Governor DuPont succeeded in fulfilling both his promises. He slashed the rates, increased the revenues, and spent more on the public services. It's always seemed to me to be a wholly admirable approach to politics, and one which I trust my colleagues will agree with when we come to draw up our manifesto for the next election. I think British science still has an enormous amount to contribute. It has a huge achievement behind it. We also have a great history of very entrepreneurial companies where the scientist and the businessman combine or can even be the same person. I think we need to release more of those energies. In a world of the microchip and of the software house, I think those energies can be released here in Britain. It is the kind of technology and business that we should welcome and excel at. I'm not sure we were so good at 20th century factory organization, which seemed to be better handled in America and Germany. I think we will be much better at 21st century business organization from the home, from the computer link, over the internet, where our talents will flourish rather more.
Thank you very much indeed. Mr. Edward has agreed to answer questions.
Dennis Noble, Oxford University. Mr. Edward, I listened to your talk with great interest and took a lot of detailed notes, and I hardly disagree with a single thing you said, and I say that with some degree of surprise. I don't know whether I should be congratulating you or whether you should be congratulating SBS, but let me try and focus on the one thing that I'd like to take you up on, though. you praise the Josiah Wedgwoods of this world, I think you'll find many of those in the science community in Britain today. And from what you said, I think you would agree with that view too. There are many with innovative technology ready to be exploited, no question about that. You highlighted the reluctance of the City of London to get involved. Well, again, I'm sure you wouldn't disagree with this. It's not just the Rolls and Bentleys who finally can't interest the City of London, it's people like us. If I may just quote my own example, I founded two biotechnology companies. One of them is in the United States. It's in the United States and now valued at $50 million, because at the stage when it was valued at $1 million, which is what was needed, the City of London didn't take it on. And we could repeat this story time and time again. Now, and this is the bit that really surprised me. If I understood you right, you said, and I agree with this too, this needs some kind of a cultural change in bringing together two great strengths of Britain, its City of London and its science and technology. And you then want to say that the route through for this was to bring in tax breaks. Well, I tell you, SPS has been arguing for tax breaks in this area, I think, ever since it was founded. I have to tell you, too, that some, at least, of your former colleagues in the previous governments disagreed with this. Now, what I want to put there for you as a question is this. Has something changed? I don't mean necessarily in your view, but has something changed in the culture of thinking about these things? And how exactly would you see the tax breaks working? Because this is an area where we've been pressing for a long time. We've put a lot of research into it. We're going to hold a symposium on it in the new year and in the City of London too. So the issue is hot for this organisation.
Well, I'm very grateful to you, and your direct experience bears out the line of thought I was developing. I have experience of the city and of industry, so I think I perhaps can criticise and comment on both sides. And I am very disappointed by the reluctance of the City of London to get behind new ventures. I think it has been a long-standing problem in the City of London. Times behind older ventures as well, in the way I described in the example which I used, being a well-known example that people could relate to. I don't know exactly how we're going to crack it, and the idea which you and I seem to be agreeing on of tax breaks, I think, is the most obvious one which a government can look at. I will be putting this to my colleagues when we form our manifesto proposals for the next election, which will be a little way distant, but it's certainly the way my mind is going at the moment. And I would like us to look again at what we did do on venture capital, where we did introduce some tax breaks, and see whether there are ways of repackaging them, representing them, or making them more generous, which might do more of the job that we wanted to do. I think they've been moderately successful, but there are many examples like your own which don't seem to have responded. I think it may also require financial intermediary businesses to be established in the provinces and on the internet rather than in the City of London. I think the city is simply too expensive now for the smaller venture capital. That's why they always want such huge fees and such enormously quick and large payoffs, because their own cost base is very high. And I think maybe the way it will be cracked is by the recreation of a series of provincial financial intermediaries and mini financial exchanges around the provinces, which we had in the heyday of Victorian enterprise capitalism and which were lost in the second half of the 20th century as the agglomeration and centralizing began and got underway. And I think that might be a very necessary part of what's going to happen. It is beginning to happen in some of the provincial centres. If you go to Leeds today, it is a much more serious financial centre than it was 20 years ago, one of Britain's biggest and most underrated cities, and there is now a pool of financial and advertising and marketing expertise in Leeds that Yorkshire businesses can draw on rather than going to London, just as there used to be that expertise in Glasgow and Liverpool in the great days of those cities. I think we need to help Manchester and certainly Leeds and maybe one in the West and one in Scotland to become serious provincial centres where more of this financial intermediation can be done in the smaller scale at more sensible fees, and that might fill in the gap in the market.
Yes, I, like Dennis, took quite a lot of notes and found myself agreeing with you quite a lot. What, may I make a comment first and then ask you a question? My comment is that almost everything you said about what was desirable was the opposite of what your government actually did. Now, to point out one or two
things. Wasn't my government.
For instance, take the simple thing about technicians, which we all agree with. One of the things was abolishing the polytechnics. Then was a mistake in that respect, because you stopped and produced a lot of the polytechnics now want to emulate universities rather than producing people before. You left the science budget in a worse state than you found it. And so I was surprised that you said that you wanted it up. The last point in this bit of it is regulation. Of course, lack of regulation led to BSE, which cost, what, $4 billion? And so I cannot see that any sensible person would argue for lack of reducing regulation generally. Now, my particular question is that, as you know, clusters, and you made the argument about clusters, I thought very well, they probably start off in a random sort of way, that somebody starts something in the Silicon Valley, and then other people add on. I didn't understand the mechanism you had in mind between decreasing taxes and getting a cluster. And that was my question.
Well, I'd like to comment on your comments as well, I think. Taking the two comments together, yes, we have changed. One of the messages of William Hague is just that we have listened, we have learned a lot from our bitter experiences in 1997, and we are getting back together with the people we ought to be representing. I spend a lot of my time travelling the country, listening rather than lecturing, as do my colleagues. And we accept that we made mistakes and that we need to present something better, showing that we've learned from those mistakes. And we made a huge mistake in the early 90s, which I think I was the first Tory to apologise for, but William has apologised on behalf of the whole party, and that was the economic policy of the ERM, which did so much damage to British business and industry in the 92 period. And other second-order mistakes were also made, which we wish to get right next time. So yes, we are listening, we are changing. And we don't think we have to defend everything we did in the past. The electorate rejected what we did in the past in no uncertain terms. So we are starting again. We're building a new Conservative Party based on principles that are constant over the years, but based on new policies and new ideas that reflect those principles in the modern age. On your point about regulation, we will, of course, in due course, be told what the government's definitive view is of why the BSE crisis happened and whether it was a lack of regulation or the wrong kind of regulation. My experience is rather stronger in financial regulation, and I would put it to you that even with very tight and intrusive regulatory systems, you still don't stop disasters and frauds. Indeed, there is quite a lot of evidence in the financial regulatory system that the more regulation you have, the less interested the regulators are in the really big problems, a whole bank collapsing, a hedge fund collapsing and threatening to take down all the world's markets with it, or a really big fraudster, and the more interested they get in second and third order issues, which I think can be sorted out by a competitive marketplace. If regulation really worked, LTCM would never have happened. The world did hold its breath for a week or two, and how lucky we are that the Federal Reserve Board is run by somebody who knows what he's doing. Because he took the necessary action and stopped the collapse of LTCM being urgent and imminent and taking down with it a large number of otherwise solvent and sensible trading houses on both sides of the Atlantic. And so the regulatory system had failed, the hedge funds had got through the net despite very expensive regulation in the US. Your particular question was on clusters. Well, I think the way you create clusters is by creating a favourable general business climate, and then we will be attractive to investment. That is, after all, what has happened in the Thames Valley and in Silicon Glen with the development of high-tech business. Some of it has been indigenous, some of it has been imported. A lot of the big companies from America have decided to come to Britain. It was a combination of several things. The largely common language obviously helps, but the exchange rate was right when they came. The tax rates were lower in Britain than anywhere else in Europe apart from the Republic of Ireland. They liked the general business climate. The industrial relations problem had been largely sorted out by the changes in legislation in the 80s, it became fashionable to come to Britain and they helped form clusters. It is terribly important not to upset that settlement and to start driving them away. One of my worries is that we are doing just that at the moment. If you combine the 25 billion of extra business taxes over the lifetime of this Parliament with the 5 billion a year of extra regulatory cost of the minimum wage and the working time regulations, the possible and actual green taxes that we have experienced and will experience, the attack upon motoring and motor transport generally, and the high exchange rate that we're currently running, you get a much less favourable climate for business. And so instead of seeing a continuing surge of inward investment, you now see quite a few inward investors actually pulling out altogether, or threatening to pull out because they don't find the climate so attractive.
I'd like to follow up on what Dennis Noble said. I'm an applied mathematician. I work at Brunel University in the UK and at the University of Texas. And my speciality is modelling the behaviour of polymeric materials. And the big difference between running a research institute here and one in Texas is this tax break. And the reason I come back to it is that you answered the question from the point of view of venture capital. What would be so good in the UK, which would emulate what happens in the US, is if there was a tax break so that a small company, an SME, could come to me and say, we would like you to do so and so for us, and we would use your results, and we can afford to do it because there is a tax break. In the US, this happens. Also, there's a very nice thing in Texas where you can get matching funds from the state of Texas for the entrepreneurial money. But if there was a tax break here, so that SMEs, instead of saying we can't afford it, say yes, we can afford it because of the tax break, I think that the interaction between academia and small companies would increase enormously.
Yes, I'm grateful for your development of that idea, and I think that is a very good proposition. I think universities are going to have to get money from a whole variety of sources, not just from the government. And I think we need in Britain to get rather better at that and to start matching the success of some of the great American institutions. A lot of British universities haven't really tapped their ex-alumni in the way that a US university would do as a matter of course. A lot of universities haven't exploited their natural advantages in helping create business parks and business environments close to the university in the way that Cambridge has definitely done and the way that one or two others are beginning to do. My own former college in Oxford as an undergraduate was Magdalen College. Under its current president, it has been brilliantly successful, both at tapping ex-alumni for money, as I well know, and at developing a rather smaller version of the Cambridge Science Park on the edge of Oxford on a piece of land they thoughtfully acquired. And they are now getting a very important independent income from the science park to pay for the college, which obviously enables them to maintain the fabric and employ more and better talented people at the college. I think we need to look at all those sort of routes to link business with the university. There's another area which I would like to sound out rather more on and take more advice on, but that is whether we need to look at the permitted arrangements for good academics in universities to also have business interests and take on other activities. I think there is a role for this. I don't think it should be mandatory. I think there are quite a lot of academics who want to be pure academics and should get a decent salary for so doing. But I also think there are quite a few people who would like to do a bit of each, and they might like to start growing a business whilst continuing as part-time teachers at the university. And I think we should look at whether the current arrangements make that easy, whether they are fair to both sides of the equation, both to the employing university and to the business that they're developing, and whether they need to be better formalised and made more flexible.
Rob Dowell, Technology Consulting. I'm sure you're aware that British investment in R&D in both the private and public sector is way below the OECD average. Would you believe that increasing this level of investment would give an economic benefit? And if so, would you argue this should be a goal for a future Conservative administration?
I seem to remember the figures we used when we were ministers, supplied by our independent civil service, purported to show that the publicly financed R&D was comparable, but the not with the states because of their defence, but with the European partners, but that the private sector financed R&D fell behind. I don't know whether that's still true, and you might want to query the figures. Yes, of course, I would welcome more R&D. It has ultimately to be a decision in the private sector made by the people running the business. But I do think we need to promote and encourage a culture where those running great businesses and small businesses understand that what they're doing today is unlikely to be earning their living in 5 years' time. We're living in a world that is very fast changing indeed. And if you have a successful product or service today, it is very unlikely to be equally successful and as equally reliable in 5 years' time. You should constantly be planning your own obsolescence and developing the successor, otherwise your competitor will do so, and you will be placed in a very difficult position. I found when I was the chairman of an industrial group, I had to be the voice for the future. I inherited a group with extremely good financial controls. Accountants had been all over it. They could tell you the cash flow every month to the last penny. They knew the production costs. They'd done all those sort of things. But there was no real voice for the future in the group. And so that was what I chose as one of my roles. And I just used to go around saying to people running companies, even profitable companies, good companies, are you sure you're committing enough to the future? Because I can promise you what you're doing today won't be earning your living in 5 years' time. And I think we do need to find that voice for the future. And I would be very open to persuasion on what other action government could take in order to strengthen that voice for the future in other companies. I've no idea. What would you like the answer to be? You tell me whether you think she is.
Whether I think it's... That's not really my place, is that?
Oh, go on, feel free. It's a free country. It's the first question I've ducked, so I'd love to hear your view.
Could you repeat the question?
It's about our new science ambassador, Lara Croft.
Fine. Well, I'm happy with that answer. I don't have a strong view. Well, no, because it's your answer. I really don't have a strong view on it. I'm interested in your contribution. You could argue it's a gimmick. You could argue it's a serious role. We will find out, won't we? I'm not sure there is such a big difference as all that. Maybe I know a little less about the other culture than you do, but I think I know a bit about it. And I think maybe the differences can be exaggerated. I think in most companies, well, in all the companies I've been involved with, they've worked well where people have collaborated. You don't normally in a company appoint an opposition and ask them to storm around the business complaining about everything the management's doing. The only area we do that in Britain is government. I think rightly so, because I think you need to keep them up to the mark. It always used to amuse me when people would say during our dark days in the Conservative administration, you know, why is your press so awful? And this was a businessman saying this. And I would say, well, you try running your business with 300 people on your payroll whose only job is to try and get nasty stories about you in the newspapers. Maybe you would find it quite difficult to keep a good press as well. But that is democracy. I don't think that happens in British companies. I think all the successful British companies I know through most of their time do have good collaboration within the business. And if any senior management team starts to lose the loyalty or goodwill of the employees, then things do start to go quite wrong quite quickly. And in the British media-driven culture, we normally find out about it. You see the stunning boardroom row stories and the nasty stories about the bosses being planted by the employees. It doesn't happen in many companies at a time. But you know when it does happen, something has gone wrong, and it is something out of the ordinary.
We take one last question right at the back.
Michael Powell, engineer. And I might say, I think I would prefer, really, professional engineers rather than the companies who should uphold our position. We may not have the silk and tongues, perhaps, of some of the professions who have to rely on their verbiage, but actually we're sort of used to doing it, so we talk less and do more. I would like to ask a question. One is reflecting on the period of the 60s to the 80s and the motor industry and the as you said, the secular decline. When the British Leyland Company went together, there was one good example, I think, where they had three V8 engines, one designed by Triumph, one designed by Rover, and one eventually by Jaguar. And they went on with all three, which was a great weakness in terms of investment and in management. You didn't mention also during that period the intense union strike that went on, which was part of the Second World War. The engineering, certainly, I quite agree, right through from the days of before the war and after, the Ricardos and the smaller engineering excellence is still there and has been there. Now, when you talk with the city will say short-term or long-term, or I will say short-term or long-term, and the city will say, Bunny, you've had your chance. And you look at the things, the wonderful things the engineers produced, but they didn't actually quite meet the market need. So there's nothing wrong with the engineering except that you didn't reach the market right. Now then, I think the question I would like to ask is thinking, I think the prospect of science and industry, the contemporary industry, is very considerable in this country. But I'm not sure that it will create the work. What are we going to do for the still numerous number of people there are who actually aren't going to fit into the factories of the contemporary factories of tomorrow?
Yes, I'm never too worried about where does all the work come from. In my life, there's always been plenty of work, and I think, by and large, there will be lots of work for Britain as long as we don't mess up on the general issues that we've been discussing tonight. It used to be one of the hard questions asked in the 1980s when the Conservative government was trying to help the economy recover from the awful shock of 79-81. And people used to say, but where are all the jobs going to come from? And people were very bad at predicting where they were going to come from. Indeed, it was common view in 1982 that there wouldn't be any jobs and that the Conservatives were going to go down with a complete tragedy on unemployment, and employment would never be generated. Over the 80s, jobs were created in all sorts of areas that people hadn't thought of, largely service-related, but massive new service industries developed, financial services, security, all sorts of things developed, which were not thought to be big job generators in the 70s and early 80s. I guess there will be hundreds of thousands or millions of jobs generated in various parts of the world, those that get the climate right, in these exciting new technologies that are going to dominate and take over our lives. There are going to be all sorts of jobs generated by internet and digital transmission technology that we can scarce envisage at the moment, but whole new ways of doing things are developing apace as a result of the phenomenal power of the combination of computing and new transmission systems. So I think that's where the jobs will come from. I agree with you that in the 60s, union disruption or bad relations between managers and employees was a very crucial part of the story. And I'm sure you're right that there were some rationalizations that could have been done in what went on under the bonnet, which might have helped reduce the costs. But there were other examples of rationalizations that did the opposite, that if you put the same door handles on the bottom of the range car as you put on the top of the range car, it actually put off the people buying the top of the range car, which was the one that you were more likely to make money out of. I think the new Rover and the new Jaguar designs, which I saw at the motor show this year, are stunningly good. I think Rover was unlucky launching at 75 at the same time as Jaguar launched the S-Type, because I think the S-Type is slightly better than the 75, but they are both remarkably good products. I just hope now that their respective new owners put enough tool power and muscle power behind it in Britain to sell in high volume, because they really ought to be selling around the world and not just specialising in the British market.
Well, I think it's time to bring this phase of the proceedings to the close. On your behalf, I'd like to thank you very much, Mr. Redwood, for speaking to us tonight. You've said, I think, a considerable number of things that perhaps we didn't expect to hear, and that clearly the development within your party of policy is proceeding apace, and we look forward to seeing how that goes on. Thank you very much again.